The Tom Woods Show, episode 1211.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you've ever considered starting your own podcast or self-publishing a book or just earning affiliate commissions the way all the cool kids do online or starting an online business, I've got step-by-step instructions on how to do all these things because, well, frankly, I've done all these things. Get your copy of my free ebook on all this at pathstoincome.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Phil Magnus joins us again on the show. We've talked to Phil before, and he's joining us to talk about an issue that came up, I don't know, a year or so ago. I had Tom DiLorenzo on to talk about it. A woman named Nancy McLean, a historian, wrote a book on James Buchanan, who is an economist who is associated with the public choice school of economics. And she's arguing in the book Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, that Buchanan more or less spearheaded or was the heart and soul of a radical plan to insinuate the so-called right wing into the sinews of American society. And in particular, she argues that Buchanan was a supporter of segregation and that segregation is really more or less secretly at the heart of what the right wing is up to. I mean, it's just, it's as crazy as you would think it would be. I had Kevin Gutzman, who has both a PhD in history and a JD. So he's crazy loaded up with degrees. And he said that in his graduate program at the University of Virginia, there was a left liberal professor who, in a small seminar or book reading group, recommended that everybody read McLean's book on the Ku Klux Klan. And then when they met, he apologized to them for having made them read that book, which he decided was a terrible book. Well, I'm sure it's much better than Democracy in Chains, which is based on nothing. The insinuations in this book and the claims in this book are beyond belief without foundation. And not to mention, she shows her complete lack of knowledge of the world that she's supposedly immersed herself in on every single page. And, you know, in fact, she was even asked if she could even try to explain the motivations of the people she chronicles. And she really couldn't. You know, it's just, well, some people just want to be evil. Even if I wrote a book on some lefty, I would at least try to understand that person. Say, well, in that person's mind, this is the way the world looks, and therefore you need to do X, Y, and Z. I could at least do that. What other job as a historian would I really have if not first to try to understand the subject I'm chronicling? Anyway, Phil Magnus is a skilled historian in his own right, and he joins us today to bring us up to date on how Nancy McLean has responded to these various arguments and what the future holds for the legacy of poor James Buchanan after this drubbing. Phil, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk Nancy McLean. It's about a year since that controversy. I just reminded folks about it. It's interesting, of course, to look at how she's dealt with the fallout from her book, and I do want to talk about that. But I think there's also a bigger issue here, which is it's true that there were on the right wing, I want to be as fair as possible, it's true that there were wild speculations about Barack Obama and stuff like that. And I don't think Barack Obama was a communist. If he's a communist, he's the most ineffective communist ever. He got Obamacare through, and that's about it. I mean, I don't like him, but so, I mean, there's some fevered stuff. That's true. But I personally feel like the conspiratorial stuff on the left, where they see white supremacy or would-be white supremacy absolutely everywhere, and they are tracing out lines of influence from one group to another, and they think that the GOP has some big plot to bring the government down. Half the time they're accusing people right of center of downright evil things. Half the time they're accusing them of being open anarchists. If only that part were true, but it's true only in their minds. But do you see what I'm driving at? Whole idea that there's a crazy that there's this line going from of all people, an academic economist, James Buchanan, down to the modern GOP, there's nothing to this. But it's a subset of this larger left-wing view of the world.
Right, right. And, you know, the historian I like to quote, even though he's very much in the progressive tradition, is Richard Hofstadter, who wrote this great little essay in the early 1960s called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And he was writing at the time that, you know, things like the John Birch Society were very active. He was writing about conspiratorial thought emerging on the political right. But he very importantly set out in the essay, says this is not something that's exclusive to one ideology. All sides are susceptible to it. But if you go through Hofstadter's essay and what he delineates as the characteristic of a paranoiac, it basically fits to a T some of this conspiracy theorizing that's coming out of the McLean world, that's coming out of some of the academic left that has accepted and integrated this work into their narrative. It's basically the notion that you have this avant-garde of society that detects a conspiracy at play before anyone else notices it, and they view it as their mission to announce to the world, basically, that the conspiracy is happening, the conspiracy is happening, you better pay attention to it or else you're going to get caught by it. But really what's going on is just a manifestation of increasingly, and I dare to use it, the word delusional paranoias that have just zeroed in and pinpointed on a certain theme. In this case, it happens to be James Buchanan as like kind of the conspiracy master that's driving all the things that they find distasteful about the world around them.
There's no nuance whatsoever. I don't think most left-wingers even know that the Kochs were against Trump, for instance. Isn't that kind of important detail?
Yeah, and I don't think Nancy McLean even knows that the Kochs were against Trump. She just had a big appearance over the weekend on Bill Maher's show, and one of her things was she's claiming that the recent, the Twitter feud that's emerged between the president and the Koch brothers, this has come out over a couple of recent breaks in their political network. She's claiming that this is kind of like a false flag operation to distract attention from the approval of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. But when she's framing this up, she claims that the Kochs were okay with Trump's immigration crackdown, for example, and okay with his tariffs until Brett Kavanaugh came along. But if anyone has followed the Koch network's positions on this issue, they've been denouncing the president pretty much consistently since Inauguration Day, specifically on the issue of tariffs, specifically on the issue of immigration. So it's not even attached to reality where this argument's coming from.
Yeah, and the Koch brothers' opinions on topics like this aren't something of recent origin either. You go back years and years and seeing them saying the same thing. So all that's crazy. So what you did, you wrote an academic paper on this, on the Nancy McLean book, and we're going to link to that at tomwoods.com/1211. People should take a look at that. But then she's now had to some degree, she's had to respond, but it's almost always it may be literally always with softball interviewers who are saying, right. It's sort of like when Brian Gumbel would interview Hillary Clinton, what's the worst thing the Republicans have said about you? He thought that was a pressing question. So that's the sort of thing. Well, geez, they're saying that you're all wrong, but where are they wrong? That sort of thing.
Right,
so how
right,
has
right.
she dealt with the fact that you've shown, well, first, why don't we start there? What did you show?
Yeah. So, the paper, as I said, it's at the link, but the paper is basically a historical investigation into one of her core claims. Her core claim is that James Buchanan, this economist that is best known as kind of the founder of the public choice tradition of economic thought, basically gained his intellectual moorings in the aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education. So she spins kind of this fanciful tale together that says that Buchanan arrived at the University of Virginia right in the aftermath of Brown, which is, in terms of date, it's true. He got there in 1956. But she claims that Buchanan had kind of a visceral reaction to Brown and viewed it as, the oppressive federal government coming in and stomping on states' rights or something of this nature. Of course, Buchanan never wrote anything of that nature in his entire 20-volume corpus of published works, nothing at least that we found. But she claims that there's this segregationist motive underlining pretty much everything that Buchanan is developing in that time. And she does a lot of this as argument by innuendo. So she doesn't come out and say, well, Buchanan was a segregationist. She actually argues instead that Buchanan gave kind of academic veneer to segregationist arguments, or that Buchanan aligned with and utilized segregationist allies in politics to advance other libertarian objectives, the foremost being school vouchers. And what we did in the article is explored this just as a historical claim, see if there's any evidence for it. And what we find is time and time again is that whenever McLean insinuates a connection between the segregationist and Buchanan, if you look at the sources, it's simply not there. And in fact, there's other exculpatory evidence that suggests that Buchanan at this time is actually in favor of desegregation, that Buchanan's intellectual priors come out of the University of Chicago tradition, which views segregation as a market inefficiency, as something that if markets are allowed to operate freely, will be squeezed out, driven out. He basically forms an early version of what is more commonly associated with an argument by Gary Becker and Milton Friedman, these two Chicago theorists that view discrimination as an economic matter. Buchanan takes similar types of arguments, so the cues are all there. We also know from some of his statements that he reflects unfavorably upon the political situation in Virginia over segregation. So the best evidence, the preponderance of evidence that we have available to us says that not only is McLean wrong, but she's just completely misconstrued the history of Buchanan at that time. And this is something that comes out of many, many months of deep archival digging, of working in the exact same paper she claims to have viewed and utilized in her own work. But what we find is over and over again, her claims just simply don't hold up. They don't hold water.
So then now she's forced to, at least to some degree, answer to this. I mean, it's not in the way that you would cross-examine her, but right. She has to acknowledge that there are critics of what she's said. How has she answered it? I mean, there are so many specific things you could say about her misunderstanding of public choice, or I think at one point she said that public choice was non-empirical. What's wrong with you? All you have to do is flip through a public choice journal to see that. So she's not. No one's going to call her on that. Because her critics or rather her friends aren't even going to know anything about public choice. But she's had to address the fact that there are people against her. What's been her response?
Yeah, it's been full-fledged conspiracy theory, and this started right off the bat. So I think I was the second critic who had published anything at all about her book. So I did a short, very narrow piece on one of her claims about racism, one of her claims about segregation. And this appeared on the History News Network, which is kind of an aggregator site for historians. Actually, Ken Saleen left of center, but it's a very mainstream type of a publication. And the editor of the site agreed to run my piece, and he extended an invitation to her saying, we're going to give her a response. He asked me if this was okay. And I said, yeah, absolutely. I want to see how she responds to this criticism of the way that she's used evidence. And a week goes by and there's nothing, no answer from her. And then this was about, I want to say July of last year. So it's about a month or so after the book came out and the criticism starts. She makes this post on social media and circulates it around her Facebook and Twitter and all the different platforms, gets some of her friends to pick it up. And it's this lengthy kind of conspiratorial rant that makes a number of unhinged allegations about her critics, presumably including myself and others who had started to kind of pile on some of the evidentiary problems in this book. And she starts making claims like that the Koch Brother Network has bought ads on Google to suppress the rankings of her book on search engines. She found out that's not even possible to do that. Google doesn't sell that type of an advertisement or service, let alone there's no evidence that the Koch brothers did any of that. She also claims that there's a campaign to suppress her star ratings on Amazon because she's getting hit by some of these negative reviews from readers of the book. And then she turns around and basically calls on progressive activists to do exactly what she's accusing the conspiracy of doing to her. She says, go flood Amazon with favorable 5-star reviews. Doesn't matter if you've read the book or not. I need these to prop up my work and fight off this insidious Koch conspiracy that's coming after me. And of course, hundreds of, if not thousands of progressive activists do that. She gets promotional material out of the book. But in the entire process, she completely shirks any normal pattern of intellectual response to her critics within the academic profession. She basically is shunning the process of peer review and shunning the process of regular review of her work after it's come out. So from that point into today, she's kind of doubled down into this position where she won't even engage in an interview or won't even attend an academic conference if she knows that a critic from what she calls the Koch Network is going to be there. And that means basically any academic anywhere who's ever done anything with the Koch Foundation in terms of funding. So it's basically like this discriminatory stance she's taken against it. She's not going to acknowledge any critics, no matter how substantive, no matter how strong their evidence is, so long as they're associated with a political faction that she sees as being kind of the heart of this conspiracy.
It would be as if we came up with a theory that Robert Byrd, the former Klansman, had himself hatched a plan whereby he was going to claim to have repudiated the Klan, but instead, through the Democratic Party, implement policies that on the surface would seem favorable, but in fact would price blacks out of jobs, would make life increasingly difficult for them in one way or another. Look at how it's worked. Look at the past 50 years. You've had Democrats in charge of every major city practically. And what have been the results educationally and every other way? You could say, look, the welfare state sounds like a good idea, but we know that actually it'll keep them down and it'll keep them voting for us. You could come up with that. Now, there's no basis in that. There's no basis to that. There's no evidence that there was such a conspiracy. But if we did promote that theory, the major media would be on us constantly 24 hours a day, and such a book would go absolutely nowhere. So, Phil, here's my radical proposition. It's almost as if there's a kind of a bias built into the way controversies like these are covered.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you supposed to say to that, Phil? This is so obvious.
Right.
I've left you with no response.
Of course I'm going to think there's a bias. I think what it is revealing, and I think this is the more disturbing element of the McLean story, is that quite a bit of the academic profession has just kind of credulously accepted her narrative as, here's an eminent historian. She claimed James Buchanan, or very strongly implied James Buchanan, was motivated by racial animosity. She claims very strongly that Buchanan's ideas are rooted in the backlash against Brown versus Board, even though she doesn't really have any evidence of that claim. But they accept it at face value, and they repeat it not based on any independent assessment that they've made of her evidence. Rather, it's repeated on her reputation as a chaired professor of history at Duke University, her reputation as someone who's written well-regarded prior academic works. So she's kind of trading in on her currency as a well-known historian to make these charges, these claims that really have never been subjected to true peer review. One thing I keep pointing out about the book is it was published on the trade press. It never went through the normal process where they send out the manuscript to actual experts and say the thought of James Buchanan or the thought of, or public choice theory, and ask them to evaluate the quality of the work. She never did that. Rather, what happened is she went through a mass paperback type trade press that published it as a political work, and yet you have academics that are kind of doing this pivot because of her acclaim as a historian, her reputation as a leading figure of the profession. They're trading in on that reputation to then kind of post hoc validate everything that she claims in the work, even though it's never been subjected to any type of real rigorous academic scrutiny. So I see that as a failing of the intellectual profession itself, and it's perhaps even more pernicious as a manifestation of anything that we'd see in say, like a media treatment of this.
Yeah, no kidding. So tell me something about this Uncoke My Campus group. They seem like a bunch of fun people.
Yeah, they're certainly interesting, and they've been all over the McLean story. She regularly cites them as kind of an authority that this conspiracy is trying to suppress her work. So basically, Uncoke My Campus, it's a group of very, very radical far left, I guess the leader of it's a college dropout who basically in his years at Florida State was involved in just about every type of far lefty cause that one could imagine. And this goes up to and including holding speaker events that promoted revisionist histories of the Kim Jong-un regime in North Korea, revisionist histories of communist states that present them in a favorable light. So really, really far lefty activist. And around 2012, 2013 or so, he kind of zeroed in on the Koch brothers as being the center of what he thought is kind of this capitalist conspiracy to take over the universities. Why? Because there are a couple libertarian economists at the Florida State Econ Department, and they had received grants and fundings out of the Koch Foundation. So this character kind of built an organization that has gained some currency in the political left by kind of putting forth this claim that they're seeking transparency in the university system, seeking to force the Kochs to disclose where they've made donations. It's actually quite ironic that they go this route, because Uncook My Campus doesn't disclose its own donations, doesn't disclose its own funding, and it seems almost singularly unconcerned with any source of funding that comes out of the political left. So George Soros, Tom Steyer, those types of figures that have very large academic operations and donations of their own are almost completely exempted from some of these similar demands. But what it amounts to is basically there's this pretty far left type of an activist group. And over the past years or so, they've really kind of gained currency as a source of, I'd even go so far as to say, outright harassment of the very, very small number of professors on the libertarian to conservative end of the political spectrum that are in academia. Basically, what they do is they go around from university to university trying to stir up controversy that seeks to undermine any source of research funding and political support or academic support that's received out of the Koch network, just by drawing attention to alleged controversy, but doing so in a very biased, one-sided type of a way that only seems to apply the standards to funding sources that come from a political perspective they dislike.
This is what concerns me about if these folks really ever did come to power. We're seeing the way they would want to govern, in that they can't, if you and I were to be dropped on any random college campus today, anyone at random, we would have to hire a private detective to find anybody on the faculty who wasn't part of the overall university groupthink. And we all know that. Everybody who isn't hysterical knows that. That's a fact of life in America. And the idea that you would be concerned about the relative handful of people who have a dissident view means that you're an insane control freak who can't tolerate dissent. Why would I want those people in charge? Then I recently interviewed somebody, Janice Fiamengo, who was an English professor who was brought before the Ottawa Human Rights Commission. And we talked about what are, you know, by the standards of the Western legal tradition, obvious irregularities in the way those sorts of cases are heard. Again, going to show that when it comes to the exercise of raw power, we don't care about your 800 to 1,000-year-old legal traditions. We want what we want. And that's what is most disturbing about these people. You see how they act, and you think, what if they had the – I mean, they, to some degree, they're getting winked at by the state, but what if they had the coercive arm of the state behind them?
Yeah, it is frightening. And I guess 2 points I'd make on that. The first one's empirical. You have this massive conspiracy theory being spread about what is literally – in terms of numbers, less than 10% of U.S. college faculty today are of any stripe on the political right. And we have survey after survey that shows that the majority of them lean left, and that ranges from center left to outright Marxist. But it's certainly the dominant faction in academia. And yet you have these groups and figures like McLean that are identifying that tiny 10% or less minority on the political right as supposedly being the source of all evil in the world. But this goes straight back to Richard Hofstadter's paranoid style. And I'll give you a short passage that comes out of that essay. And he's referring to a classic characteristic of the paranoiac. He says the paranoiac basically sees the enemy as something that's totally evil, totally unappeasable, and therefore he must be totally eliminated, if not from the world, at least from the theater of operation to which the paranoid directs his attention. Here we have paranoids like McLean. They direct their attention to academia. Therefore, the objective is to purge what they see as the evil, i.e. Buchanan, public choice theory, the Koch brothers, libertarians, free markets, whatever it is on their litany of adversaries. They see it as the objective to purge that out of the theater or arena in which they are active, which is academia.
So what does this all mean, the whole Nancy McLean controversy, for the future of scholarship related to James Buchanan?
Right. And this is where I'll end on kind of a silver lining. One thing McLean has done even though she spins kind of this fanciful conspiracy attack, and in some ways it's quite defamatory at points. You know, she's basically calling a dead guy a segregationist, refusing to acknowledge anything that would allow the guy to defend himself or his friends, his intellectual heirs, his students to defend him, but asserting that this this kind of malicious and very salacious charge should be attached permanently to his academic legacy. And you know, basically her objective is that every time public choice theory comes up in the academic production of another scholar, she basically would like a world where we all have to answer the peer reviewer who says, oh, that Buchanan guy you're quoting, wasn't he a racist? Wasn't he a segregationist? Didn't he support John C. Calhoun or some other fanciful claim that she makes? So that does seem to be an objective that's coming out of the other side. But the silver lining is that it's kind of mobilized and reinvigorated a new interest in Buchanan scholarship. You have dozens of academics that are, in fact, versed in the public choice tradition, that know the material much better than McLean or any of her defenders happen to know it, have started turning to kind of a history of economic thought as a way of investigating Buchanan's ideas. So issues that have basically kind of been left unturned or that were maybe a more minor concern before McLean came along and studying Buchanan's life have really been teased out and brought to the forefront. And I'd argue, and you know, I'm partial to my own paper on this, I'm partial to some other scholars that are sympathetic on this, but if you read it, Buchanan actually comes out pretty good in the end, especially with his engagement in some of the controversies of his day, including the segregation issue. For example, we previously didn't know, no one had really studied what Buchanan's thoughts were on race in the 1950s and 60s. You start poking around, and even though it's by no means a central focus of his attention, every time it does come up, you know, he's basically saying, you know, the segregation stuff, this is kind of state oppression in action. There are instances when he weighs in on the voucher debate, one that we just recently found from 1964. He does a follow-up report to one of these key papers that McLean uses in her her argument, and he inserts a line and says, wait a minute, if vouchers were being directed to private schools that are segregated, this is actually a basis where we should restrict the voucher system. We should keep them out of the segregated private schools because that's not right. That's not equitable. So Buchanan, if you actually look at the material, actually look at the history that has kind of been invigorated in the fallout from this controversy, he comes out much, much better, not only than she portrays him, but better than a lot of the more sympathetic voices in the public choice side of the academy even realize, because we just never really looked at that question with the depth that it's now being given attention. And I think that is a silver lining, that in the long run, you know, kind of Buchanan's story, if evaluated against the actual evidence that's there, it's grounded in serious substantive engagement with his work, he comes out much better than we even previously thought when she started attacking him.
Well, I suppose that is a silver lining, but man, geez, we had to go through the ringer for that silver lining. But yeah. I'm glad you were out there doing what you did. I read a lot of commentary from people who knew Buchanan or respected him all over Facebook and in the blogosphere, but you were just the most consistent, relentless, punishing voice of all, I would say. So I'm appreciate it. So people should check out your paper. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1211, as I said. And they should also pay you a visit over at Phil Magness. That's M-A-G-N-E-S-S, philmagness.com. Phil, thanks so much again.
Yeah, thanks again.
All right, folks. Well, if you're looking for more podcast content, I've got a listener who has just started a brand new one. Let me tell you, when you start a new podcast, you need listeners. And I want to help this guy get going. It's actually called Hate the State. You can find out about it at hatethestatepodcast.com. And you can see just from the topics that you would be interested in this kind of question. Like, for example, there's an episode on what happened to make the guy go anti-war. I'm always interested in that story. That story in particular, even more than what makes people libertarians. What makes them anti-war, given the propaganda to the contrary? He's got episodes on Karl Marx, on property rights, on how to answer people who think there are reasons we actually need inflation, like there are good economic reasons that we might actually need some inflation. That's a standard view among a lot of mainstream economists, and he's going to address that. Venezuela and why that's not actually a problem of state capitalism, as the socialists try to claim. All kinds of great topics. So definitely give it a try over at hatethestatepodcast.com. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1213. And of course, remember that you too can get a shout out like this, plus many valuable bonuses that will help get you up and running with your website or blog from me. So you got to get your hosting through my link, but you'll get these benefits from me, and they're going to help, in some cases, make the difference between success and failure. You need that burst of traffic, and I'll help bring it to you. How do you get these bonuses? Check out tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.